life without death. So that's, I think, is a very powerful teaching tool. When you have this kind of experience, you don't need to be told not to worry about death. It's like the information is given to you. Again, the noetic quality of the experience is important. And sometimes you can be told something in one of these experiences that you already know cognitively, but you get it so directly that it makes an incredibly powerful impression on you. This is another vision. One night when the moon was dark and my bedroom was inky black, I sensed a presence in the corner of the room. I was afraid. The presence grew and grew and then filled the entire room. I lay in terror with my eyes tightly closed. A voice, deep and gentle, said to me, "Love. The whole thing is love." Slowly the energy ebbed from the room, leaving me in paralyzed terror in the darkness. Now, it's nothing new to be told that the whole thing is love and the importance of love and so on. All the traditions talk about that. But when you get it in this form, in this way, it has this indelible effect on. And this is a woman who'd had enormous difficulty with loving and being loved. And so this was why the experience was healing. It had done this woman no good to go to church any number of times and be preached at about love. It has no effect at all. But when you have the experience like this, that's the value of direct experience. It goes right to the core of the individual. That's why one could call this approach to spirituality an experiential approach. It's not a dogmatic or doctrinal approach. Another important aspect of this is the numinosum in nature, in the natural world. And let me give you one or two examples of that. Traditionally, there were many nature mystics. Certainly in Christianity, there were several nature mystics. But nowadays, we don't hear many traditional Christians talking about the sacred nature of the environment. Mostly people who talk about that nowadays are environmentalists. But I think that what drives environmentalists is actually a feeling for the numinosity of nature, for the sacred importance of nature. And they disguise it as a political movement. That's why I think they get so upset when the land is damaged. I think they experience it as sacrilege, actually. So they have this kind of experience. I was hurrying to class at the university, and because I was late, I had to cross an expanse of lawn. As I ran across the grass, I had the most amazing and horrible experience. I could feel that each blade of grass had a life force. I could feel it, that the ground had a life force, that everything was bound together in this wonderful dance. I could feel my feet crushing the blades of grass, and I could feel the pain the grass felt. This experience came totally unbidden and unexpected, and I realized that I was something more than this pocket of flesh and mind. Okay, so rather than just tell her that nature is alive and that the grass is alive, or the plants and so on are alive, here she actually experienced it. Again, there's this experience of the veil being lifted. I mean, presumably that's this kind of thing is going on all the time, all around us. And then when we have this kind of experience, the veil is suddenly lifted and we're granted a new kind of vision. And once you've had this kind of experience, you probably never experience nature again in the same way. The body, of course, is another very important neglected area that we have to talk about. This is an experience that occurred after a night of lovemaking, described by a young woman. She and her partner have been making love all night, and she said, "Suddenly, I stood outside of time. It was as if time normally flowed in a horizontal plane, and I had somehow stepped out of this horizontal flow into a timeless state. There was no sense of the passage of time. There was simply no time." This is a very transcendent state of mind that she experiences through the body. The body, as you know, has had a bad reputation in the Judeo-Christian tradition. It's been devalued a great deal. Nowadays, I think that the reason that we have so many forms of body therapy and body psychotherapy is that people are beginning to re-experience the actual numinosity of the body. I mean, in its better moments, the tradition has recognized that the body is the temple of the spirit. That has certainly been said, but it's also been devalued and demonized. And I think that as that attitude is fading a little, people are having more and more and more numinous experience in the body, and the interest in yoga and all these body therapies is a reflection of the fact that people are experiencing the numinosum through the body nowadays. I have some more examples, but I think it would be tedious to... I think you've gotten the point. So I'd like to talk about a kind of experience that I think might be a bit controversial. And it has to do with the use of psychedelics. And the argument is whether psychedelics produce, like LSD and psilocybin and so on, whether they produce authentic spiritual experience or not. The people who say that they don't say that these compounds just screw up your brain, they disturb your brain chemistry, and... You're just getting a distorted experience based on the fact that your brain isn't working properly. People who do believe that these are authentic, for example, Houston Smith wrote a book a few years ago, and he uses, well, I've forgotten the title of it, I think it's called Cleansing the Doors of Perception, or some phrase like that. He uses the phrase entheogens. It's E-N-T-H-E-O-G-E-N-S. And if you break that down etymologically, it means the birth of the divine within. So rather than call them psychedelics, if you believe that these do produce authentic spiritual experience, you can call them an entheogen. You may still get arrested for taking it, but that's another problem. But let me tell you why I'm in the school of thought that thinks that they produce authentic experiences. I've heard several experiences like this. Having taken an entheogen, I suddenly felt myself floating. I seemed to exist as pure consciousness within brilliant light, and I felt blissful peace and joy. I became aware of two beings composed entirely of light. We discussed my path in life and their relevance to my life's purpose. The deep wisdom and compassion of these beings helped me understand and accept several painful life events and feel forgiveness towards people who'd hurt me. I felt relief and emotional healing. They led me to a golden platform that was like a stepped pyramid. At the top was a blaze of brilliant diamond light, radiantly clear, sparkling with flashes of color. I sensed this was a divine presence. The light coalesced into the form of a goddess. No words were exchanged, just unspeakable reverence and devotion on my part and unfathomable love on hers. I knew that she was Kuan Yin, the Bodhisattva of compassion in the East. She smiled at me and then turned her gaze at what appeared to be the earth far below, surrounded by the darkness of space. As I looked at the planet, I saw countless drops of light, which I knew represented every living being on the earth. My heart opened. I experienced incomparable love for all life and the deepest compassion I have ever known. I felt unconditional love for all, including rapists and murderers, whom I loved with the sadness of one who sees their suffering. I knew them as lost souls who had forgotten their true nature, and I felt a deep desire to help guide each one towards their birthright. Looking at Kuan Yin, I realized that my experience was simply a reflection of her divine nature shared with me at this moment. Now, this is the experience. Someone say that this is the experience of a disordered brain, to me, sounds crazy itself. I mean, it would sound defensive to say that. This is high-level spirituality. This can't be the result of a disordered brain. In my misspent youth, when I used to do psychiatry, I saw a lot of people in toxic confusional states. Most of them didn't remember what they'd experienced, and the ones that did never told me anything like this. This is something else, I think. This woman had been raised in a very abusive household and been very ridiculed by her mother. And Kuan Yin is the archetype of the compassionate divine mother of the kind she didn't have as a child. So the vision was very helpful. Now, again, depending on your commitment, you could dismiss this as defensive, or you could, with Jung, you could say this is an example of healing contact with the numinous. I would say that the coherence of the experience and the high level of spirituality in it is evidence that it's authentic, but it's very hard to prove one way or the other. It's really a matter of commitment. All these things are still a matter of commitment. They're not matters of proof. But I always tell students that when you do research, you're allowed one miracle. You've got to prove the rest, but you've got to begin somewhere. And that's the miracle that you're allowed to begin with. If you have to prove the thing you begin with, the axiom that you begin with, that's a whole other piece of research. So my miracle is that I take these things at face value as authentic experiences of the sacred, but I can't prove it, really. I think we're supposed to stop at 9, is that right? I was asked to talk a little bit about relationship the numinosity of relationship. I was reading recently about these new mega churches where 3,000 people might be in the congregation. And when I've talked to people who are very keen churchgoers and I've asked them, why do you go to church? Mostly, they don't give me explanations in terms of esoteric theology. They go from church to church until they find one that they like. And when I ask them why they like it, they don't tell me, well, the theology here is, I prefer it to the theology there, and this doctrine's better than... They say, I like the people more. I get along with the people. It's all about the search for community. And I think what's really numinous for many people who go to church and synagogues nowadays is actually the sense of community, the sense of connection with other people. And they're sitting there and they're singing all these hymns and things, but what they really care about is the connection to other people around them. I think that's where the numinosum is really manifesting itself. And I think that that's what's going on in some of these very large congregations. The people don't care so much about the theology. They care about being with other people. Now, again, there are psychoanalytic explanations for this. If you know Kohut, he has a whole thing on what's called the twinship transference, where we like to be with people who are like us, who believe the same things that we do, who share the same ideals and values and so on. So, you know, anything can be reduced. But I think there's more to it than that. I think, you know, those of us who go to church or synagogue at, you know, at Easter or the Jewish High Holy Days or Christmas or whatever it is, because we feel like we're supposed to, the most we ever get out of it is a sense of the family or a sense of connection to other people. It really is not the theology or the doctrine or the dogma that's being talked about. It always seems to me it's about the connection. Well, why is that? Well, I think it's because we are all expressions of the same self, the same capital S self. I'll be talking more about this tomorrow when I talk about the non-duality in depth psychology. But Jung is very clear that this self, this image of the divine, that is, if you're an object relations theorist, you could talk about this as an a priori object, an a priori internal object that the baby is born with, that's there, present at birth, not the result of internalization. That upsets a lot of object relations theorists because they have a thing about internalization. But actually, you're born with this already there. That's sort of the Jungian contribution. That's why somebody calls it the 2-million-year-old man, should be person. But there's something already there when the baby is born. There's this self, capital S self, already present. And every human being is an expression of that, is that, actually. Just as, for example, all snowflakes, even though they look, every snowflake looks different, but they're all water. So you can have difference without, you can have distinction without a difference, in a way. That's not a very good metaphor. I can't really find a good metaphor, but I can only kind of gesture at what I'm talking about. Basically, it's the same sense, it's the same self in all of us, or we're all expressions of the same self. Now, sometimes when we get deeply connected with other people, we feel that sense of the self in the other, which it's like the biblical phrase, deep calls to deep. You have a resonant experience with that in the other, which is actually the same as that in yourself. And that's, in a nutshell, is what makes relationships so numinous. That's what you're really connecting with. Now, some people project the self onto other people. We call that idealization. And so we can idealize all kinds of strange people. And when we idealize people, you know, the self-psychologists have discovered this and they call it idealization. And they think it has to do with the need for soothing and all the rest of it, the need for comfort, the need to find somebody who has goals and values that you can follow if you don't have an internal sense of direction. There's a whole psychoanalytic explanation of why we need to idealize somebody and see them as wonderful and larger than life and so on. The real reason is that we're searching for a divinity, and instead of experiencing it in ourselves, we project the self, or we project the experience of the divine onto other people. So idealization of another person, like falling in love, when you first fall in love, is an experience of the divine embodied in the other person. Why it wears off is a whole other problem. But I think it's those kind of dynamics, the experience of the divine in the other, or the resonance of that in oneself and in the other, that makes relationships so numinous. So that's the short answer to your question. Okay. So it's 9:05, so can we just spend 5 minutes with questions? Or? Yes. Comment on it? Yeah. I beg your pardon, I couldn't hear you. Oh, it can do. Yeah, the question was about active imagination and whether it meets Otto's criteria. You can definitely have numinous experiences in active imagination. And you can do it in the body. You know Jendlin's focusing method? I don't know if you're familiar with that. There's a way of doing active imagination in the body. But the short answer is yes, you can definitely have numinous experiences doing active imagination, because they're really waking dreams. So I would say yes. Maybe everyone's stunned into silence. We could stop. Yes. Okay. Oh, it's going to be difficult, I can tell. Yeah.
Religions grew up around them.
Yeah.
Then you had a bunch of people who were organized around that religion.
Yeah.
The imagery.
Right.
The numinous experiences.
Right.
With some people and not others.
Right.
There's difficulties, wars.
Yeah.
Awful things. Now we've got a emerging spiritual practice arising out of psychology.
Right. Right. Oh, in groups, yeah.
The
question is, does this have anything to do with groups? Or maybe community would be a better word.
Have you reflected on the interface of this emerging spiritual practice and the need for community and expression of this?
Yeah. The question is about how is this relevant, am I paraphrasing, how is this relevant to community and how would this express itself in community?
Yeah.
Something like that. I think that the function of a spiritual community should be to help everybody in it find his or her own experience of the sacred. I would suggest, instead of everybody experiencing the sacred, say in the form of Jesus or the Buddha or in some single way, that the community helps every individual find his or her own way. That would be the way, and that we respect each other. See, the last thing we want is all these wars over competing God images, which is obviously absurd. And that's what we have now. We have the experiences of the founders, Muhammad and Jesus and Moses and so on, and then all these different God images and ways of thinking about it are causing wars. Well, we've tried that for 2,000 or more years. That doesn't work. We should try something else. Don't you think it's time? And what we could try is simply saying that there's a debate in the literature about whether what I'm talking about is a via positiva or a via negativa, whether this is whether these are saying something about the nature of the divine in a positive way or not. And I would say that because there are so many God images that could manifest themselves, so many ways that the sacred could manifest themselves, that you end up having to appropriate a via negativa. You have to end up saying, none of these are the thing itself, none of these are absolute, none of these would apply to everybody. They're just instances that are useful, and even for the individual, they can change. I could give you a quick example of how they could change if you would like to hear this. A friend of mine told me this experience, and actually I just emailed her this morning and got a note back, and I'm going to put this in my new book, so I have her permission to talk about this publicly. She said she started off her life, she had a very austere, angry father. And so when she started to work on her father material, she had a dream in which she's suspended by a huge hook up in the sky, and an old man with a long white beard and a white robe, who she realizes is God the Father, is down below and fires cannonballs at her, and she's helplessly suspended. Now that is a classic example of how, you know, many people have written about this. Anna Maria Rizzuto and Michael Sinclair and all kinds of people have written about how your experience